The views and opinions expressed on this podcast belong solely to the individuals appearing on the program and do not necessarily reflect the views of the organizations with which these individuals are associated. You're listening to the Humanitarian Assistance Podcast, produced by ATA, the Advanced Training Program on Humanitarian Action. This podcast is a space for professionals from around the world to engage with a global panel of experts and practitioners on current dilemmas in humanitarian action. You can be part of this discussion. Just go to ata.se. There, you'll find background information related to each episode, our blog of weekly analysis of current trends and challenges in the humanitarian sector, and much more. Now, let's get started.
Hello, and thanks for listening to the Humanitarian Assistance Podcast. I'm Julia Brooks. In this episode, my colleague Meredith Blake speaks with Dr. Michael Van Rooyen, the director of the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative and chairman of emergency medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital here in Boston. Meredith, you're usually behind the scenes here at ATA on our podcast and as program coordinator. So first of all, I'd like to welcome you to your first time in the podcast host seat.
Thanks so much, Julia. It's great to be here. And yes, as you mentioned, I'll be joined by Dr. Michael Van Rooyen, an emergency physician with a wealth of experience in humanitarian response, who's worked for a number of NGOs in over 30 countries affected by war and disaster. He's also a professor at Harvard Medical School and the Harvard School of Public Health. In an upcoming memoir entitled The World's Emergency Room, Mike reflects on the evolution of the aid community over the last several decades. I recently sat down with him to discuss what he considers to be today's most pressing challenges in humanitarian assistance and aid delivery.
Sounds great, Meredith. And one final reminder before we begin. You can find resources related to each episode of the podcast by visiting our website, ata.se. And if you have feedback regarding any of our podcasts, you can reach us on Twitter at @ATASweden or using the hashtag ATA.
Thanks, Julia. Now let's get started. Mike, thanks so much for joining us. Let's start at the very beginning of your career. How did you first get involved with humanitarian assistance, and what drew you to this field?
Hi, thanks, Meredith, and thanks again for having me on the podcast. You know, I first became really interested in the humanitarian field as a physician. I was an emergency medicine physician who really had a particular interest in emergencies and traumas and kind of vulnerable populations. And then I had an interest in global health that really led me to look into the humanitarian field. Ultimately, after my residency training in emergency medicine, I went abroad and worked in Somalia. And it was in Somalia in particular that I became really interested in conflict and the effect of conflict on populations and the sort of very difficult nature of serving populations in that setting.
And just to follow up on that, can you tell us a little bit about how you progressed from those earlier stages and ended up in your current roles now?
Sure. So I kind of had a dual career path. I'd worked as an emergency physician and then kind of took a time off all the time and headed abroad and worked in Bosnia and Rwanda and Sudan and Somalia and North Korea and Iraq and a lot of different sort of relief settings. And in so doing, I really began to understand the complexities of working in conflict and also the gaps. In other words, the problems that faced humanitarian aid agencies and the problems that I was facing as an individual. I'd come back and work then as an emergency physician and kind of catch up and try to re-immerse myself in my life as an ER doc and then go back to the field again. And as I did that, I realized that the world didn't need more humanitarian aid. It needed better aid. And it needed a way to then gather evidence, translate evidence to the field, and train the future leaders in the field. And that's really why I became interested in combining academics and humanitarian aid.
Could you actually tell us a little bit about some of the gaps that you were first seeing?
Sure. I mean, and I'll speak kind of from a personal perspective because I was an imperfect addition to the aid environment myself. As I worked in the field as a physician, I realized I was probably fairly well-trained emergency physician from Western standards, but my ability to apply my trade, say, in Bosnia, for example, was really limited. I mean, I didn't understand the culture. I didn't understand the real issues, particularly kind of war-wounded patients and what they were facing. I didn't know the other actors that as I was working with them. And I just wasn't kind of comfortable in that space. So I ended up trying to apply Western methods to a context that was really different. And I looked around and saw a lot of people doing that. So I think that there were a lot of people working in humanitarian aid, whether they're in medicine or in other aspects, that came and were untrained and unprepared and felt that we needed to do it better.
And now you actually spend a lot of your time mentoring and teaching young and mid-career professionals who are working in humanitarian assistance, medicine, technology, and policy. In your view, what are the key qualities and characteristics that make professionals successful in the humanitarian field? And what competencies, skills, and approaches are important for developing a career in this sector?
I thought about this a lot because I recently completed a book that explores the kind of parallel pathways in emergency medicine and humanitarian assistance called The World's Emergency Room. And in it, I kind of explore the things about an emergency physician that make us, I think, perhaps suited for the aid environment. And that is the ability to be flexible, to work in imperfect and dynamic settings, the ability to take in data quickly and make decisions with imperfect information, and still the pressure to act, but also to apply evidence. Just as an emergency physician has to use the available information they have and then come up with a way to translate evidence to a patient, in the aid community, the same applies. We have to look at a population, understand what their needs are, and apply current evidence in order to make effective decisions.
So you're saying in humanitarian action, you start looking at it as almost diagnosis of sorts?
Yeah. I mean, I think the similar things apply, right? You have instead of a patient, you have a population. And the population has characteristics that you can understand before you step into the setting. You can know how many and their needs and their problems and their issues. And then you have to work with available evidence that you have on the ground to really understand what's affecting them and how they're being affected, and then come up with a solution, right? And that solution is, of course, different than an individual in the emergency department. It's coming up with a solution like how much, and the types of medical aid to provide, for example, the types of needs they have and how to serve them best. So in that respect, there is some sort of similarities.
And on that note, actually, I'd like to turn to some of the challenges humanitarian professionals have faced in the past and what they're up against in today's environment. The success of humanitarian assistance depends directly on humanitarian actors' ability to reach populations in need. Yet in some of the most complex environments we're currently facing, such as Iraq, Syria, and Yemen, delivery of aid is often obstructed. In your view, how has aid delivery in these unstable areas changed over the years? And how are we navigating access in light of these new challenges?
I think the primary theme in the changes in the humanitarian environment is the issue of perceived neutrality. And that is the degree to which humanitarian actors are seen as being beneficial to the population and neutral so that they are not seen as warring parties, combatants, or party to the conflict. It's been a palpable erosion that I've seen over the course of my career. And 20 years ago, a NGO t-shirt and a white Toyota Land Cruiser gave you some degree of access and safety because you were embedded in your community. Now you become a target, and the prevailing threats for aid actors, for example, is now just direct attack. And hospitals are being targeted, healthcare facilities and ambulances, and aid providers, both national and international aid providers, are being targeted. So this notion of the erosion of neutrality has really affected our ability to gain access to populations, embed ourselves in their communities, and be seen as a productive and neutral presence, and also protect our workforce.
And building on that, what are some of the more challenging trends arising? especially in contexts that are hard to reach, either because they're too remote or too proximal to an ongoing conflict. You mentioned insecurity of aid workers. There's also the erosion of trust in humanitarian institutions due to problems with perception. How can we in the academic community, but also the humanitarian community, work to address those issues?
So I think one of, aside from this kind of concept of neutrality, it's accentuated by the fact that wars have changed as well, right? So it used to be, and in decades past, wars were between militaries and international conflicts, but with Somalia, with the Congo, with wars in the Middle East, we see these asymmetric conflicts where you have rebel militias and non-state armed actors embedded in civilian populations fighting a stronger force that tends to use larger weapons of that affects communities indiscriminately. And that mixture of blending into communities to essentially protect themselves and heavy-handed tactics by national militaries like we see in Syria, for example, create a horrible dynamic. I mean, we see civilians directly attacked, indiscriminate bombing, and then the effects of the insecurity directly on healthcare institutions. So direct attacks on healthcare workers, direct attacks on hospitals. There's a big movement underway, as we well know, and we've explored in other podcasts, the notion of the neutrality and perceived neutrality of medical institutions. The ICRC is doing terrific work in sort of bringing this to light, but some of the things that are still missing are trying to help local institutions on the ground real time employ strategies to protect themselves. And I think we still have some way to go on that.
And as a physician, you've written that emergency rooms in American cities like Detroit, Chicago, and Baltimore serve as a sort of safety net for overarching societal problems such as drug use or violence. You've also observed that humanitarian medical relief in crisis zones provides a similar sort of safety net for the communities that are affected. Could you tell us more about the similarities and differences that you see in these contexts?
Sure. And I would preface that to say that in no way am I equating emergency rooms in Detroit, Chicago, and major cities in the United States as being war zones or akin anything like war zones. The parallel I'm making is that the emergency departments in America and around the world serve as the safety net for the community. They're the 24/7 resource for things that go bad with people, whether it's trauma or injury or illness. Emergency departments sort of stand ready to take the population. Humanitarian aid is kind of like that in its sort of the philosophical approach, and that is that we may think of global health and global development in one context, but when things go wrong or unravel, populations face extreme stress and extreme vulnerability, and the aid world is there for them. So, you know, I recently wrote a book, as I mentioned, called The World's Emergency Room, which is really trying to draw that philosophical parallel between the emergency medicine system being the safety net for the community and the humanitarian aid world being the safety net for populations in crisis. Again, very different settings, very different needs and vulnerabilities, but a sort of a similar philosophy in the way that we engage with communities.
And just to expand on that analysis, I'd actually like to shift our conversation a bit to talk about technology and its implications for the humanitarian sector. Over the last decade, but particularly in the past few years, new technologies have introduced many opportunities for growth and collaboration and have affected everything from research and communications to coordination for logistics, and even, as we've seen recently, the crowdsourcing of information by refugees as they cross European borders. How can we harness these advancements to better deliver humanitarian aid? And by the same token, do you think these new opportunities also present us with new vulnerabilities that we need to be mindful of so we can work to mitigate potential risks moving forward?
So the advent of new technologies, just like it's changed your life and my life on a daily basis, the fluency of communications and cell phones and texting and internet searches and the ability to map where we're going has changed our lives radically. It's it's also, of course, changed the humanitarian business. And that is that we have much more fluency of sharing data, much more fluency of communication. And it's created an interesting and I think really an important movement in placing the power of information in the hands of communities. It used to be that, you know, the Western saviors could step in and have most of the information, all of the resources, and all of the ability to sort of step in a paternalistic sense. But first of all, that's not sustainable. Secondarily, it's not correct or at least desirable. What's desirable is to build resilience and to build community-level capacity so that people can help themselves. It doesn't always happen, and in wars that sort of unravels, right? But increasingly with new technologies and fluency of communication, fluency of the way that people share information, and they can create better models to plan, better models to participate, and better models to sort of build self-resilience.
And for my final question, I'd like to end on a slightly more positive note and just ask if, given the complexity of the world we face and the myriad of sort of growing and overlapping issues humanitarians are forced to grapple with, do you have any sense of optimism for the future of humanitarian response and maybe our collective ability to create sustainable solutions for some of the problems we've discussed?
So the aid world is radically changed in the past 20 years, and it is morphed into a very different set of structures than it used to be. It's become far more professional, far more coordinated, far more able to learn and evolve. And remember, humanitarian aid works in the most difficult spots and the most difficult conditions in the most threatening environments. It's not an easy environment. But as an industry, the humanitarian aid agencies and world has radically changed, and I think mostly for the better. There are always challenges. There's always, you know, difficulties and new actors that, you know, come in as novices, right? We always have that. But by and large, we have an aid agency that is becoming more professional and becoming more accountable, which is, I think, really important. And we're not done, but there's more work to do, but we're moving in the correct direction. I think that, you know, there's a lot of things that should give us, I guess, cause for some degree of optimism. Some of it is the adoption of new technologies and new communication strategies and sharing information. Another is the understanding that humanitarian actors need to push their efforts to a more sustainable development model so that we can actually prepare people instead of just react. Another is this notion of humanitarian engagement with academics. I know it may sound a little self-serving, right? But I think that having an academic participation into humanitarian agencies gives us a base from which we can develop new evidence, translate it to practice, and create a professional pathway for aid workers. So I think that there's cause for, I would say, cautious optimism. The world is changing pretty quickly too. But we have seen as a field the aid community really change rather radically in order to adapt to a changing environment.
Mike Van Rooyen, thanks so much for joining us today on the ATA podcast.
Meredith, thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Once again, that was Dr. Michael Van Rooyen, director of the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative and chairman of emergency medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital. I'd like to extend a special thank you to our technical director, Andy Locke, and the rest of my colleagues here at ATSA. Be sure to join us again for our monthly podcast on April 27th, when we'll be discussing the politics of aid in Ukraine. Until then, I'm Meredith Blake, and on behalf of the Advanced Training Program on Humanitarian Action, thanks so much for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Humanitarian Assistance Podcast. To share your thoughts on this episode, or to find more podcasts, videos, resources, and e-learning activities, just visit atha.se.